That was in late November, and I didn't intend to do anything more for quite a while. I doubt if I need to tell you why, but I will anyway. If anything happened to him too soon after our talk on the ferry, Selina's eyes might turn to me. I didn't want that to happen, because there was a part of her that still loved him and probably always would, and because I was afraid of how she'd feel if she even suspected what happened, of how she'd feel about me, of course. I guess that goes without saying. But I was even more afraid of how she might feel about herself. As to how that turned out, well, never mind now. I'll get there, I guess. Probably sooner than I want. So I let time go by, although that's always been the hardest thing for me to do once I've made up my mind about a thing. Still, the days piled up into weeks like they always do. Every now and then I'd ask Selina about him. Is your dad being good, is what I asked, and we both understood what I was really asking. She always said yes, which was a relief, because if Joe started up again, I'd have to get rid of him right away and damn the risks, or the consequences. I had other things to worry about as Christmas passed and 1963 got started. One was the money. Every day I'd wake up thinking that this might be the day he'd start spending it. Why wouldn't I worry about that? He got through the first 300 right smart, and I had no way of keeping him from pissing away the rest while I was waiting for time to take time, as they like to say in his AA meetings. I can't tell you how many times I hunted for the goddamn savings passbook they had to have given him when he opened his own account with that dough, but I never found it. So all I could do was watch for him to come home with a new chainsaw or an expensive watch on his wrist, and hope he hadn't already lost some of it, or even all of it, in one of the high-stakes poker games he claimed went on every weekend in Ellsworth and Bangor. I never felt so helpless in my whole life. Then there was the questions of when and how I was going to do it. If I ended up having the nerve to do it at all, that was. The idea of using the old well as a pit trap was all right as far as it went. The trouble was it didn't go anywheres near far enough. If he died neat and clean, like people do on TV, everything would be fine. But I'd seen enough of life even 30 years ago to know that things hardly ever go the way they do on TV. Suppose he fell down in there and started screaming, for instance. The island wasn't built up then the way it is now, but we still had three neighbors along that stretch of East Lane, the Karens, the Langills, and the Jolanders. They might not hear screams coming from the blackberry patch behind our house, but then again they might, especially if the wind was high and blowing the right way. Nor was that all. Running between the village and the head like it does, East Lane could be pretty busy. There was trucks and cars going past our place all the time, not as many of them back then either, but enough to worry a woman who was thinking about what I was thinking about. I'd about decided I couldn't use the well to settle his hash after all, but it was just too risky, when the answer came. It was Vera who gave it to me that time, too, although I don't think she knew it. She was fascinated by the eclipse, you see. As that winter started to wear thin, there'd be a new clipping about it pinned to the kitchen bulletin board every week. And when spring began settling in with the usual high winds and cold slops, it got to be more like every other day. There were pieces from the local papers, from away papers like the Globe and the New York Times, and from magazines like Scientific American. She was excited because she was sure the eclipse would finally lure Donald and Helga back to Pinewood. She told me that again and again. But she was excited on her own account, too. By the middle of May, when the weather started to warm up, she was spending more time on the island than she was in Baltimore. And that friggin' eclipse was just about the only thing she talked about. She had four cameras. I ain't talking about brownie star flashes, either. In the entry closet, three of them already mounted on tripods. She had eight or nine pairs of special sunglasses, specially made open boxes she called eclipse viewers, periscopes with special tinted mirrors inside them, and I don't know what else. Then, near the end of May, I came in and saw the article pinned to the bulletin board was from our own little paper, the Weekly Tide. Harborside to be Eclipse Central for residents, summer visitors, the headline said. The picture showed Jimmy Gagnon and Harley Fox doing some sort of carpentry on the hotel roof, which was as flat and broad then as it is now. And you know what? I felt something turn over in me again, just like I'd felt when I saw that first article about the eclipse pinned up in the very same place. The story said that the owners of the Harborside were planning to turn the roof into a kind of open-air observatory on the day of the eclipse. Except it sounded like the same old business as usual with a brand new label on it to me. They said the roof was being specially renovated for the occasion. The idea of Jimmy Gagnon and Harley Fox renovating anything is pretty funny when you stop to think of it. And they expected to sell 350 special eclipse tickets. Summer residents would get the first pick, then year-round residents, you had to bring your dump sticker to show which flavor you were. The price was actually pretty reasonable, $2 a throw. But of course they were planning on serving food and having a bar, and those are the places where hotels have always clipped folks, especially the bar. I was still reading the article when Vera come in. I didn't hear her, and when she spoke, I went just about 2 feet in the air. "Well, Dolores," she says, "which'll it be, the roof of the Harborside or the Island Princess?" "What about the Island Princess?" I asked her. "I've chartered it for the afternoon of the eclipse," she says. "You never," I says. But I knew the second after it was out of my mouth that she had. Vera had no use for idle talk, nor idle boasting neither. Still, the thought of her chartering a ferry as big as the Princess kind of took my breath away. "I did," she said. "It's costing me an arm and a leg, Dolores. Most of it for the replacement ferry that will run the Princess's regular routes that day. But I certainly did do it. And if you come on my excursion, you ride free with all the drinks on the house." Then, kind of peeking at me from underneath her eyelids, she said, "That last part should appeal to your husband, wouldn't you agree?" "My God," I says, "why'd you charter the damn ferry, Vera?" Her first name still sounded strange to me every time it came out of my mouth, but by then she'd made it clear she hadn't been joking. She didn't mean to let me go back to Mrs. Donovan, even if I wanted to, which I sometimes did. "I mean, I know you're excited about the eclipse and all, but you could have gotten an excursion boat almost as big down to Vinyl Haven, and probably at half the expense." She gave a little shrug and shook her long hair back at the same time. It was her kiss-my-back-cheeks look, if I ever seen it. "I chartered it because I love that tubby old whore," she says. "Little Tall Island is my favorite place in all the world, Dolores. Do you know that?" As a matter of fact, I did know it, so I nodded my head. "Of course you do. And it's the Princess which has almost always brought me here. The funny, fat, waddling old Princess. I'm told it will hold 400 comfortably and safely, 50 more than the roof of the hotel. And I'm going to take anyone who wants to go with me and the kids." Then she grinned. And that grin was all right. It was the grin of a girl who's glad just to be alive. "And do you know something else, Dolores?" she asked me. "Nope," I says, "I'm flummoxed." "You won't need to scrape your damn dump sticker off the windshield of your car to get a ticket on my..." Then she stopped and gave me the queerest look. "Dolores, are you all right?" But I couldn't say anything. The most awful, most wonderful picture had filled my mind. In it, I seen the big flat roof of the Harborside Hotel filled with people standing around like they was at a cocktail party, except they all had their necks craned back. And I seen the Island Princess stop dead in the middle of the reach between the mainland and the island, her decks also chock-a-block with people looking up, and above it all hung a big black circle, surrounded by fire in a sky filled with daytime stars. It was a spooky picture, enough to raise the hackles on a dead man, but that wasn't what had gut-punched me. I was thinking about the rest of the island that done that. Dolores, she asked, and put a hand on my shoulder. Do you have a cramp? Feel faint? Come over and sit down at the table. I'll get you a glass of water. I didn't have a cramp, but all at once I did feel a little faint. So I went where she wanted and sat down, except my knees were so rubbery I almost fell into the chair. I watched her getting me the water and thought about something she'd said the last November, that even a mathematical dunderhead like her could count back 9 months on the calendar and draw the right conclusions. Well, even one like me could add 350 on the hotel roof and 400 more on the Island Princess and come out with 750. That wasn't everybody that'd be on the island in the middle of July, but it was an almighty slug of 'em, by the Jesus. I had a good idea that the rest would either be out hauling their traps or watching the eclipse from the shingle and the town docks. Vera brought me the water, and I drank it down all at once. She sat down across from me, looking concerned. "Are you all right, Dolores?" she asked. "Do you need to lie down?" "No," I says. "I just come over funny for a few seconds there." I had to. All at once, knowing what day you plan to kill your husband on. I guess that'd be apt to bring anyone over funny. 3 hours or so later, with the wash done and the marketing done and the groceries put away and the carpets vacuumed and a tiny casserole put away in the refrigerator for her solitary supper. She might have shared her bed with the hunky from time to time, but I never saw her share her dinner table with him. I was gathering up my things to leave. Vera was sitting at the kitchen table doing the newspaper crossword puzzle. "Think about coming with us on the boat July 20th, Dolores," she says. "It will be ever so much more pleasant out on the reach than on that hot roof, believe me." "Thank you, Vera," I says. "But if I've got that day off, I doubt I'll go either place. I'll probably just stay home." "Would you be offended if I said that sounds very dull?" she asked, looking up at me. "When did you ever worry about offending me or anyone else, you snooty bitch?" I thought. But of course I didn't say it. And besides, she really did look concerned when she thought I might be going to faint, although that could have been because she was afraid I'd go down on my nose and bleed all over her kitchen floor, which I'd waxed just the day before. "Nope," I says. "That's me, Vera, dull as dishwater." She gave me a funny look then. "Are you?" she says back. "Sometimes I wonder." I said goodbye and went on home, turning the idea I'd had over and over as I went, looking for holes. I didn't find none. Only maybes, and maybes are a part of life, ain't they? Bad luck can always happen, but if people worried about that too much, nothing would ever get done. Besides, I thought, if things go wrong, I can always cry it off. I can do that almost right up to the very end. May passed. Memorial Day came and went, and school vacation rolled around. I got all ready to hold Selina off if she came pestering about working at the harborside, but before we even had our first argument about it, the most wonderful thing happened. Reverend Huff, who was the Methodist minister back then, came around to talk to me and Joe. He said that the Methodist church camp in Winthrop had openings for 2 girl counselors who had advanced swimming qualifications. Well, both Selina and Tanya Karen could swim like fish. Huffy knew it. And to make a long story at least a little shorter, me and Gertrude Karen saw our daughters off on the ferry the week after school let out, them waving from the boat at us, waving from the dock, and all 4 of us crying like fools. Selina was dressed in a pretty pink suit for the trip, and it was the first time I got a clear look at the woman she was going to be. It almost broke my heart, and does still. Does one of you happen to have a tissue? Thank you, Nancy, so much. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. Selina was taken care of. That left the boys. I got Joe to call his sister in New Gloucester and asked if she and her husband would mind having them for the last 3 weeks or so of July and the first week of August, as we'd had their 2 little hellions for a month or so in the summer a couple of times when they were younger. I thought Joe might balk at sending little Pete away, but he didn't. I suppose he thought of how quiet the place would be with all three gone and liked the idea. Alicia Forbert, that was his sister's married name, said they'd be glad to have the boys. I got an idea Jack Forbert was probably a little less glad than she was, but Alicia wagged the tail on that dog, so there was no problem, at least not there. The problem was that neither Joe Jr. nor little Pete much wanted to go. I didn't really blame them. The Forbert boys were both teenagers and wouldn't have so much as the time of day for a couple of squirts like them. I wasn't about to let that stop me, though. I couldn't let it stop me. In the end, I just put down my head and bulldozed them into it. Of the two, Joe Jr. turned out to be the tougher nut. Finally, I took him aside and said, "Just think of it as a vacation from your father." That convinced him where nothing else would. And that's a pretty sad thing when you think about it, wouldn't you say? Once I had the boys' midsummer trip settled, there was nothing to do but wait for 'em to be gone. And I think that in the end they were glad enough to go. Joe'd been drinking a lot since the 4th of July, and I don't think even little Pete found him very pleasant to be around. His drinking wasn't no surprise to me. I'd been helping him do it. The first time he opened the cupboard under the sink and saw a brand new fifth of whiskey sitting in there, it struck him as odd. I remember him asking me if I'd fallen on my head or something. After that, though, he didn't ask any questions. Why would he? From the 4th till the day he died, Joe St. George was all in the bag, some of the time, and half in the bag most of the time. And a man in that condition don't take long to start seeing his good fortune as one of his constitutional rights, especially a man like Joe. That was fine as paint with me. But the time after the 4th, the week before the boys left and the week or so after, wasn't exactly pleasant just the same. I go off to Vera's at 7 with him laying in bed beside me like a lump of sour cheese, snoring away with his hair all sticking up and wild. I come home at 2 or 3 and he'd be plunked down on the rickety back porch we had in those days. He'd drag that nasty old rocker of his out there, with his American in one hand and his second or third drink of the day in the other. He never had any company to help him with his whiskey. My Joe didn't have what you'd call a sharing heart. There was a story about the eclipse on the front page of the American just about every day that July, but I think that for all his newspaper reading, Joe had only the fuzziest idea anything out of the ordinary was going to happen later in the month. He didn't care squat about such things, you see. What Joe cared about were the commies and the freedom riders, only he called them the greyhound niggers, and that goddamn Catholic kike lover in the White House. If he'd known what was going to happen to Kennedy 4 months later, I think he almost could have died happy. That's how nasty he was. I'd sit beside him just the same, though, and listen to him rant about whatever he'd found in that day's paper to put his fur up. I wanted him to get used to me being around him when I came home, but if I was to tell you the work was easy, I'd be a goddamn liar. I wouldn't have minded his drinking half as much, you know, if he'd had a more cheerful disposition when he did it. Some men do, I know, but Joe wasn't one of them. Drinking brought out the woman in him, and for the woman in Joe, it was always about 2 days before one god-awful gusher of a period. As the big day drew closer, though, leaving Vera's started to be a relief, even though it was only a drunk, smelly husband I was going home to. She'd spent all of June bustling around, jabbering away about this and that, checking and rechecking her eclipse gear, and calling people on the phone. She must have called the company catering her ferry expedition at least twice a day during the last week of June, and they was just one stop on her daily list. I had 6 girls working under me in June and 8 after the 4th of July. It was the most help Vera ever had, either before or after her husband died. The house was scrubbed from top to bottom, scrubbed until it shone, and every bed was made up. Hell, we added temporary beds in the solarium and on the second floor porch as well. She was expecting at least a dozen overnight guests on the weekend of the eclipse, and maybe as many as 20. There wasn't enough hours in the day for her, and she went racing around like Moses on a motorcycle. But she was happy. Then, right around the time I packed the boys off to their Aunt Alicia's and Uncle Jack's, around the 10th or 11th of July, that would be, and still over a week before the eclipse, her good mood collapsed. Collapsed? Frig, no, that ain't right. It popped, like a balloon that's been stuck with a pin. One day she was zooming like a jet plane. The next she was stepping on the corners of her mouth, and her eyes had taken on the mean, haunted look I'd seen a lot since she started spending so much time on the island alone. She fired two girls that day, one for standing on a hassock to wash the windows in the parlor, and the other for laughing in the kitchen with one of the caterers. That second one was especially nasty, 'cause the girl started to cry. She told Vera she'd known the young man in high school and hadn't seen him since and wanted to catch up a little on old times. She said she was sorry and begged not to be let go. She said her mother would be madder than a wet hen if that happened. It didn't cut no ice with Vera. "Look on the bright side, dear," she says in her bitchiest voice. "Your mother may be angry, but you'll have so much time to talk about all the fun you had at good old Jonesport High." The girl, it was Sandra Mulcahy, went down the driveway with her head dropped, sobbing like her heart was going to break. Vera stood in the hall, bent over a little so she could watch her out the window by the front door. My foot itched to kick her ass when I seed her standing that way. But I felt a little sad for her, too. It wasn't hard to figure out what had changed her mood, and before much longer I knew for sure. Her kids weren't coming to watch the eclipse with her after all, chartered ferry or no chartered ferry. Maybe it was just that they'd made other plans, as kids will do, with never a thought for any feelings their parents might have. But my guess was that whatever had gone wrong between her and them was still wrong. Vera's mood improved as the first of her other guests started to show up on the 16th and 17th, but I was still glad to get away each day. And on Thursday the 18th, she fired another girl, Karen Jolander, that one was. Her big crime was dropping a plate that had been cracked to begin with. Karen wasn't crying when she went down the driveway, but you could tell she was just holding on until she was out of Vera's sight to let loose. Well, I went and did something stupid. But you have to remember, I was pretty strung up myself by then. I managed to wait until Karen was out of sight, at least. But then I went looking for Vera. I found her in the back garden. She'd yanked her straw sun hat on so hard the brim touched her ears. And she was taking such snaps with those garden shears of hers that you'd have thought she was Madame Defarge chopping off heads, instead of Vera Donovan cutting roses for the parlor and dining room. I walked right up to her and said, "That was a boogery thing you done, firing that girl like that." She stood up and gave me her haughtiest lady of the manor look. "Do you think so? I'm so glad to have your opinion, Dolores. I crave it, you know. Each night when I go to bed, I lie there in the dark, reviewing the day and asking the same question as each event passes before my eyes. What would Dolores St. George have done?" Well, that made me madder than ever. "I'll tell you one thing Dolores Claiborne don't do," I says, "and that's take it out on someone else when she's pissed off and disappointed about something. I guess I ain't enough of a high-riding bitch to do that." Her mouth dropped open like somebody'd pulled the bolts that held her jaw shut. I'm pretty sure that was the first time I really surprised her, and I marched away in a hurry before she could see how scared I was. My legs were shaking so bad by the time I got into the kitchen that I had to sit down, and I thought, "You're crazy, Dolores, tweaking her tail like that." I stood up enough to peek out the window over the sink, but her back was to me, and she was working her shears again for all she was worth. Roses were falling into her basket like dead soldiers with bloody heads. I was getting ready to go home that afternoon when she came up behind me and told me to wait a minute. She wanted to talk to me. I felt my heart sink all the way into my shoes. I had no doubt at all that my time had come. She'd tell me my services wouldn't be required any more, give me one last kiss my back cheek stare, and then down the road I'd go, this time for good. You'd think it had been a relief to get shut of her, and I suppose in some ways it would have been. But I felt a pain around my heart just the same. I was 36, I'd been working hard since I was 16, and hadn't never been fired from a job. Just the same, there's some kinds of buggery bullshit a person has to stand up to. And I was trying with all my might to get ready to do that when I turned around to look at her. When I saw her face, though, I knew it wasn't firing she'd come to do. All the makeup she'd had on that morning was scrubbed off, and the way her eyelids were swole up gave me the idea she'd either been taking a nap or crying in her room. She had a brown paper grocery sack in her arms, and she kind of shoved it at me. "Here," she says. "What's this?" I asked her. "Two eclipse viewers and two reflector boxes," she says. "I thought you and Joe might like them. I happened to have..." She stopped then and coughed into her curled-up fist before looking me square in the eye again. One thing I admired about her, Andy, no matter what she was saying or how hard it was for her, she'd look at you when she said it. "I happened to have two extras of each," she said. "Oh," I says, "I'm sorry to hear that." She waved it away like it was a fly, then asked me if I'd changed my mind about going on the ferry with her and her company. "No," I says, "I guess I'll put up my dogs on my own porch rail and watch it with Joe from there. Or if he's acting out the tartar, I'll go down to East Head." "Speaking of acting out the tartar," she says, still looking right at me, "I want to apologize for this morning and ask if you'd call Mabel Jolander and tell her I've changed my mind." It took a lot of guts for her to say that, Andy. You didn't know her the way I did, so I guess you'll just have to take my word for it. But it took an awful lot of guts. When it came to apologizing, Vera Donovan was pretty much of a teetotaler. "Sure I will," I said, speaking kind of gentle. I almost reached out and touched her hand, but in the end I didn't. "Only it's Karen, not Mabel. Mabel worked here 6 or 7 years ago. She's in New Hampshire these days, her mother says, working for the telephone company and doing real well." "Karen, then," she says. "Ask her back. Just say I've changed my mind, Dolores. Not one word more than that. Do you understand?" "Yes," I says. "And thanks for the eclipse things. They'll come in handy, I'm sure." "You're very welcome," she says. I opened the door to go out, and she says, "Dolores?" I looked back over my shoulder, and she gave me a funny little nod, as if she knew things she had no business knowing. "Sometimes you have to be a high-riding bitch to survive," she says. "Sometimes being a bitch is all a woman has to hold on to." And then she closed the door in my face. But gentle, she didn't slam it. All right, here comes the day of the eclipse. And if I'm going to tell you what happened, everything that happened, I ain't going to do it dry. I've been talking for damn near 2 hours straight by my watch, long enough to burn the oil off of anyone's bearings, and I'm still a long way from being done. So I tell you what, Andy, either you part with an inch of the Jim Beam you got in your desk drawer, or we hang it up for tonight. What do you say? There, thank you. Boy, don't that just hit the spot? No, put it away. One's enough to prime the pump. Two might not do anything but clog the pipes. All right, here we go again. On the night of the 19th, I went to bed so worried I was almost sick to my stomach with it, because the radio said there was a good chance it was going to rain. I'd been so goddamn busy planning what I was going to do and working up my nerve to do it that the thought of rain had never even crossed my mind. I'm going to toss and turn all night, I thought as I laid down. And then I thought, no, you ain't, Dolores. And I'll tell you why. You can't do a damn thing about the weather, and it don't matter anyway. You know you mean to do for him, even if it rains like a bastard all day long. You've gone too far to back out now. And I did know that, so I closed my eyes and went out like a light. Saturday, the 20th of July, 1963, come up hot and muggy and cloudy. The radio said there most likely wouldn't be any rain after all, unless it was just a few thunder showers late in the evening. But the clouds were going to hang around most of the day, and chances of the coastal communities actually seeing the eclipse were no better than 50-50. It felt like a big weight had slipped off my shoulders just the same, and when I went off to Vera's to help serve the big brunch buffet she had planned, my mind was calm and my worries behind me. It didn't matter that it was cloudy, you see. It wouldn't even matter if it showered off and on, as long as it didn't pour. The hotel people would be up on the roof, and Vera's people would be out on the reach, all of 'em hoping there'd be just enough of a break in the cloud cover to let 'em get a look at what wasn't going to happen again in their lifetimes. Not in Maine, anyhow. Hope's a powerful force in human nature, you know. No one knows that better than me. As I remember, Vera ended up having 18 house guests that Friday night, but there were even more at the Saturday morning buffet, 30 or 40, I'd say. The rest of the people who'd be going with her on the boat, and they were island folk for the most part, not from away, would start gathering at the town dock around 1 o'clock, and the old princess was due to set out around 2. By the time the eclipse actually began, 4:30 or so, the first 2 or 3 kegs of beer probably be empty. I expected to find Vera all nerved up and ready to fly out of her own skin, but I sometimes think she made a damn career out of surprising me. She was wearing a billowy red and white thing that looked more like a cape than a dress, a caftan, I think they're called, and she'd pulled her hair back in a simple horsetail that was a long way from the 50-buck hairdos she usually sported in those days. She went around and around the long buffet table that was set up on the back lawn near the Rose Garden, visiting and laughing with all her friends, most of them from Baltimore, judging by the look and sound. But she was different that day than she had been during the week leading up to the eclipse. Remember me telling you how she went zooming back and forth like a jet plane? On the day of the eclipse, she was more like a butterfly, visiting it among the plants, and her laugh wasn't so shrill or loud. She seen me bringing out a tray of scrambled eggs and hurried over to give me some instructions, but she didn't walk like she had been walking the last few days, like she really wanted to be running, and the smile stayed on her face. I thought, she's happy, that's all it is. She's accepted that her kids aren't coming and has decided she can be happy just the same. And that was all, unless you knew her, and knew how rare a thing it was for Vera Donovan to be happy. Tell you something, Andy. I knew her another 30 years almost, but I don't think I ever saw her really happy again. Content, yes, and resigned, but happy, radiant and happy, like a butterfly wandering in a field of flowers on a hot summer afternoon? I don't think so. Dolores, she says, Dolores Claiborne. It never occurred to me until a lot later that she'd called me by my maiden name, even though Joe was still alive and well that morning, and she never had before. When it did occur to me, I shivered all over, the way you're supposed to do when a goose walks across the place where you'll be buried some day. Morning, Vera, I said back. I'm sorry the day's so gray. She glanced up at the sky, which was hung with low, humid summer clouds, then smiled. The sun will be out by 3 o'clock, she says. "You make it sound like you put in a work order for it," I says. "I was only teasing, of course." But she gave me a serious little nod and said, "Yes, that's just what I did. Now run into the kitchen, Dolores, and see why that stupid caterer hasn't brought out a fresh pot of coffee yet." I set out to do as she asked, but before I got more'n 4 steps toward the kitchen door, she called after me just like she'd done 2 days before, when she told me that sometimes a woman has to be a bitch to survive. I turned around with the idea in my head that she was going to tell me the same thing all over again. She didn't, though. She was standing there in her pretty red and white tent dress, with her hands on her hips and that horsetail lying over one shoulder, looking not a year over 21 in that white morning light. "Sunshine by 3, Dolores," she says. "See if I'm not right." The buffet was over by 11, and me and the girls had the kitchen to ourselves by noon, the caterer and his people having moved on down to the Island Princess to start getting ready for Act 2. Vera herself left fairly late, around 12:15, driving the last 3 or 4 of her company down to the dock herself in the old Ford ranch wagon she kept on the island. I stuck with the washing up until 1 o'clock or so, then told Gail Levesque, who was more or less my second in command that day, that I felt a little headachy and sick to my stomach, and I was going to go on home, now that the worst of the mess was ridded up. On my way out, Karen Jolander gave me a hug and thanked me. She was crying again, too. I swan to goodness that girl never stopped leaking around the eyes all the years I knew her. "I don't know who's been talking to you, Karen," I said, "but you don't have nothing to thank me for. I didn't do a single solitary thing." "No one said a word to me," she says, "but I know it was you, Mrs. St. George. No one else would dare speak up to the old dragon." I gave her a kiss on the cheek and told her I thought she wouldn't have nothing to worry about as long as she didn't drop any more plates. Then I set out for home. I remember everything that happened, Andy. Everything. But from the time I stepped off Vera's driveway and onto Center Drive, it's like remembering things that have happened in the brightest, most real-seeming dream you've ever had in your life. I kept thinking, "I'm going home to kill my husband. I'm going home to kill my husband." Like I could pound it into my head the way you'd pound a nail into some thick wood like teak or mahogany, if only I kept at it long enough. But looking back on it, I guess it was in my head all the time. It was my heart that couldn't understand. Although it was only 1:15 or so when I got to the village, and the start of the eclipse still over 3 hours away, the streets were so empty it was spooky. It made me think of that little town down in the southern part of the state where they say no one lives. Then I looked up at the roof of the harbor side, and that was spookier still. There must have been 100 people or more up there already, strolling around and checking the sky like farmers at planting time. I looked downhill to the dock and seen the princess there, her gangplank down and the auto deck full of people instead of cars. They was walking around with drinks in their hands, having themselves a big open-air cocktail party. The dock itself was crammed with people, and there must have been 500 small boats, more'n I'd ever seen out there at one time anyway, on the reach already, anchored and waiting. And it seemed like everyone you saw, whether they was on the hotel roof or the town dock or the princess, was wearing dark glasses and holding either a smoked glass eclipse viewer or a reflector box. There's never been a day like it on the island before or since, and even if I hadn't had in mind what I did have in mind, I think it would have felt like a dream to me. The green front was open, eclipse or no eclipse. I expect that booger'll be doing business as usual, even on apocalypse morn. I stopped in, bought a bottle of Johnny Walker Red, then walked on out East Lane to the house. I gave the bottle to Joe first thing, didn't make any bones about it, just plopped it into his lap. Then I walked into the house and got the bag Vera had given me, the one with the eclipse viewers and the reflector boxes in it. When I came out on the back porch again, he was holding that bottle of scotch up so he could see the color. "Are you going to drink it or just admire it?" I asked him. He gave me a look, kind of suspicious, and says, "Just what the hell is this, Dolores?" "It's a present to celebrate the eclipse," I said. "If you don't want it, I can always pour it down the sink." I made as if to reach for it, and he yanked it back real quick. "You've been giving me one hell of a lot of presents just lately," he says. "We can't afford stuff like this, eclipse or no eclipse." That didn't stop him from getting out his pocket knife and slitting the seal, though. Didn't even seem to slow him down. "Well, to tell you the truth, it's not just the eclipse," I says. "I just been feeling so good and so relieved that I wanted to share some of my happiness. And since I've noticed that most of what seems to make you happy comes out of a bottle." I watched him take the cap off and pour himself a knock. His hand was shaking a little bit, and I wasn't sorry to see it. The raggeder he was, the better my chances would be. "What have you got to feel good about?" he asks. "Did somebody invent a pill to cure ugly?" "That's a pretty mean thing to say to someone who just bought you a bottle of premium scotch," I said. "Maybe I really should take it back." I reached for it again, and he pulled it back again. "Fat chance," he says. "Then be nice," I told him. "What happened to all that gratitude you were supposed to be learning in your AA? He never minded that, just went on looking at me like a store clerk, trying to decide if someone had passed him a phony tin. "What's got you feeling so goddamn good?" he asks again. "It's the brats, isn't it? Having them out of the house." "Nope, I miss them already," I said. And it was the truth, too. "Yeah, you would," he says, and drinks his drink. "So what is it?" "I'll tell you later," I says, and start getting up. He grabbed my arm and said, "Tell me now, Dolores. You know I don't like it when you're fresh." I looked down at him and says, "You better take your hand off me, or that expensive bottle of hooch might end up getting broke over your head. I don't want to fight with you, Joe, especially not today. I've got some nice salami, some Swiss cheese, and some water biscuits." "Water biscuits," he says. "Jesus wept, woman." "Never mind," I says. "I'm going to make us a tray of hors d'oeuvres. Every bit as nice as the ones Vera's guests are going to have out on that ferry." "Fancy food like that gives me the shits," he says. "Never mind any horse's ovaries. Just make me a sandwich." "All right," I agreed. "I will." He was looking toward the reach by then. Probably me mentioning the ferry had put him in mind of it, with his lower lip pooching out in that ugly way it had. There were more boats out there than ever, and it looked to me like the sky over him had lightened up a little bit. "Look at him," he says, in that sneering way of his, the one his youngest son was trying so goddamn hard to copy. "Ain't nothing gonna happen that's any more'n a thunderhead going across the sun. And they're all just about shooting off in their pants. I hope it rains. I hope it comes down so hard it drowns that snooty cunt you work for, and the rest of 'em too." "That's my Joe," I says. "Always cheery, always charitable." He looked around at me, still holding that bottle of scotch curled against his chest, like a bear with a chunk of honeycomb. "What in the name of Christ are you running on about, woman?"
"Nothing," I says. "I'm going inside to fix the food. A sandwich for you and some hors d'oeuvres for me. Then we'll sit and have a couple of drinks and watch the eclipse. Vera sent down a viewer and a reflector box thingamajig for each of us. And when it's over, I'll tell you what's got me feeling so happy. It's a surprise."
"I don't like fucking surprises," he says.
"I know you don't," I told him. "But you'll get a kick out of this one, Joe. You'd never guess it in 1,000 years. Then I went into the kitchen so he could really get started on that bottle I'd bought him at the Greenfront. I wanted him to enjoy it. I really did. After all, it was the last liquor he was ever going to drink. He wouldn't need AA to keep him off the sauce either, not where he was going. That was the longest afternoon of my life, and the strangest, too. There he was, sitting on the porch in his rocker, holding the paper in one hand and a drink in the other, bitching in the open kitchen window at me about something the Democrats were trying to do down in Augusta. He'd forgotten all about trying to find out what I was happy about, and all about the eclipse as well. I was in the kitchen making him a sandwich, humming a tune, and thinking, make it good, Dolores. Put on some of that red onion he likes and just enough mustard to make it tangy. Make it good, 'cause it's the last thing he's ever going to eat. From where I was standing, I could look out along the line of the woodshed and see the white rock and the edge of the blackberry tangle. The handkerchief I'd tied to the top of one of the bushes was still there. I could see that, too. It went nodding back and forth in the breeze. Every time it did, I thought of that spongy well cap right under it. I remember how the birds sang that afternoon, and how I could hear some of the people out on the reach yelling back and forth to each other, their voices all tiny and far. They sounded like voices on the radio. I can even remember what I was humming. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. I went on humming it while I made my crackers and cheese. I didn't want them any more than a hen wants a flag, but I didn't want Joe wondering why I wasn't eating either. It must have been 2:15 or so when I went back out on the porch with the tray of food balanced in one hand like a waitress and the bag Vera'd give me in the other. The sky was still overcast, but you could see it really had gotten quite a bit lighter. That was a good little feed, as things turned out. Joe wasn't much for compliments, but I could see from the way he put down his paper and looked at his sandwich while he was eating that he liked it. I thought of something I'd read in some book or saw in some movie. The condemned man ate a hearty meal. Once I'd got that in my head, I couldn't get rid of the damn thing. It didn't stop me from digging into my own kip, though. Once I got started, I kept going until every one of those cheese and cracker things were gone, and I drank a whole bottle of Pepsi as well. Once or twice, I found myself wondering if most executioners have good appetites on the days when they have to do their job. It's funny what a person's mind will get up to when that person's nerving herself up to do something, isn't it? The sun broke through the clouds just as we were finishing up. I thought of what Vera'd told me that morning, looked down at my watch and smiled. It was 3:00, right on the button. About that same time, Dave Pelletier, he delivered mail on the island back in those days, drove back toward town, hell-bent for election, and pulling a long rooster tail of dust behind him. I didn't see another car on East Lane until long after dark. I put the plates and my empty soda bottle on the tray, scooching down to do it, and before I could stand up, Joe done something he hadn't done in years. Put one of his hands on the back of my neck and give me a kiss. I fared better. His breath was all booze and onion and salami, and he hadn't shaved. But it was a kiss just the same, and nothing mean or half-assed or peckish about it. It was just a nice kiss, and I couldn't remember the last time he'd given me one. I closed my eyes and let him do it. I remember that, closing my eyes and feeling his lips on mine and the sun on my forehead. One was as warm and nice as the other. That weren't half bad, Dolores, he said, which was high praise coming from him. I had a second there when I kind of wavered. I ain't gonna sit here and say different. It was a second when it wasn't Joe putting his hands all over Selena that I saw, but the way his forehead looked in study hall back in 1945. How I saw that and wanted him to kiss me just the way he was kissing me now. How I thought, if he kissed me, I'd reach up and touch the skin there on his brow while he did it. See if it's as smooth as it looks. I reached out my hand and touched it then, just like I'd dreamed of doing all those years before, when I'd been nothing but a green girl. And the minute I did, that inside eye opened wider than ever. What it saw was how he'd go on if I let him go on, not just getting what he wanted from Selena, or spending the money he'd robbed out of his kids' bank accounts, but working on him, belittling Joe Jr. for his good grades and his love of history, clapping little Pete on the back whenever Pete called somebody a kike, or said one of his classmates was lazy as a nigger. Working on him, always working on him. He'd go on until they were broke or spoiled if I let him. And in the end, he'd die and leave us with nothing but bills and a hole to bury him in. Well, I had a hole for him, one 30 feet deep instead of just 6, and lined with chunks of fieldstone instead of dirt. You bet I had a hole for him. And one kiss after 3 years, or maybe even 5, wasn't going to change it. Neither was touching his forehead, which had been a lot more the cause of all my trouble than his puling little dingus ever was. But I touched it again just the same, traced one finger over it, and thought about how he kissed me on the patio of the Samoset Inn while the band inside played Moonlight Cocktail, and how I'd been able to smell his father's cologne on his cheeks when he did. Then I hardened my heart. "I'm glad," I said, and picked up the tray again. "Why don't you see what you can make of those viewers and the reflector boxes while I do up these few dishes?" "I don't give a fuck about anything that rich cunt gave you," he says. "And I don't give a fuck about the goddamn eclipse either. I've seen dark before. It happens every goddamn night." "All right," I says. "Suit yourself." I got as far as the door, and he says, "Maybe you and me can get up to Dickens later on. What would you think about that, Dee?" "Maybe," I says, all the time thinking there was going to be plenty of Dickens, all right. Before it got dark for the second time that day, Joe St. George was going to get more Dickens than he'd ever dreamed of. I kept my good weather eye on him while I was standing at the sink and doing up our few dishes. He hadn't done anything in bed but sleep, snore, and fart for years, and I think he knew as well as I did that the booze has as much to do with that as my ugly face. Probably more. I was scared that maybe the idea of getting his ashes hauled later on would cause him to put the cap back on that bottle of Johnny Walker. But no such bad luck. For Joe, fucking, pardon my language, Nancy, was just a fancy, like kissing me had been. The bottle was a lot realer to him. The bottle was right there where he could touch it. He'd gotten one of the eclipse viewers out of the bag and was holding it up by the handle, turning it this way and that, squinting at the sun through it. He reminded me of a thing I saw on TV once, a chimpanzee trying to tune a radio. Then he put it down and poured himself another drink. When I came back out on the porch with my sewing basket, I saw he was already getting that owly red-around-the-eyes look he had when he was on his way from moderately tickled to thoroughly tanked. He looked at me pretty sharp, just the same, no doubt wondering if I was going to bitch at him. "Don't mind me," I says, sweet as sugar pie. "I'm just going to sit here and do a little mending and wait for the eclipse to start. It's nice that the sun came out, isn't it?" "Christ Dolores, you must think this is my birthday," he says. His voice had started to get thick and furry. "Well, something like it, maybe," I says, and began sewing up a rip in a pair of little Pete's jeans. The next hour and a half passed slower than any time had since I was a little girl, and my Aunt Cloris promised to come and take me to my first movie down in Ellsworth. I finished little Pete's jeans, sewed patches on 2 pairs of Joe Jr.'s chinos. Even back then, that boy would absolutely not wear jeans. I think part of him had already decided he was going to be a politician when he grew up. And hemmed 2 of Selena's skirts. The last thing I did was sew a new fly in one of Joe's 2 or 3 pairs of good slacks. They were old, but not entirely worn out. I remember thinking they would do to bury him in. Then, just when I thought it was never going to happen, I noticed the light on my hand seemed a little dimmer. "Dolores," Joe says, "I think this is what you and all the rest of the fools have been waiting for." "Yeah," I says, "I guess." The light in the dooryard had gone from that strong afternoon yellow it has in July to a kind of faded rose, and the shadow of the house laying across the driveway had taken on a funny, thin kind of look I'd never seen before and never have since. I took one of the reflector boxes from the bag, held it out the way Vera'd showed me about 100 times in the last week or so, and when I did, I had the funniest thought. "That little girl is doing this too," I thought. the one who's sitting on her father's lap. She's doing this very same thing. I didn't know what that thought meant then, Andy. And I don't really know now. But I'm telling you anyway, because I made up my mind I'd tell you everything. And because I thought of her again later. Except in the next second or two, I wasn't just thinking of her. I was seeing her. The way you see people in dreams. Or the way I guess the Old Testament prophets must have seen things in their visions. A little girl, maybe 10 years old, with her own reflector box in her hands. She wearing a short dress with red and yellow stripes. A kind of sundress with straps instead of sleeves, you know. And lipstick, the color of peppermint candy. Her hair was blonde and put up in the back like she wanted to look older than she really was. I saw something else as well, something that made me think of Joe. Her daddy's hand was on her leg, way up high, higher than it ought to have been, maybe. Then it was gone. "Dolores," Joe asked me, "you all right?" "What do you mean?" I asks back. "Course I am." "You looked funny there for a minute." "It's just the eclipse," I says. And I really think that's what it was, Andy. But I also think that little girl I saw then and again later was a real little girl, and that she was sitting with her father somewhere else along the path of the eclipse at the same time I was sitting on the back porch with Joe. I looked down in the box and seen a little tiny white sun, so bright it was like looking at a 50-cent piece on fire, with a dark curve bit into one side of it. I looked at it for a little while, then at Joe. He was holding up one of the viewers, peering into it. "God damn," he says. I didn't know if he'd changed his mind or if it was the booze talking and didn't care. "She's disappearing, all right." The crickets started to sing in the grass right about then. I guess they'd decided sundown was coming early that day and it was time for them to crank up. I looked out on the reach at all the boats and saw the water they were floating on looked a darker blue now. There was something about them that was creepy and wonderful at the same time. My brain kept trying to believe that all those boats sitting there under that funny dark summer sky were just a hallucination. I glanced at my watch and saw it was going on 10 till 5. Still over half an hour until the eclipse would be total, which meant that for the next hour or so, everyone on the island would be thinking about nothing else and watching nothing else. East Lane was dead empty. Our neighbors were either on the Island Princess or the hotel roof, and if I really meant to do him, the time had come. My guts felt like they were all wound into one big spring, and I couldn't quite get that thing I'd seen, the little girl sitting on her daddy's lap, out of my mind. But I couldn't let either of those things stop me or even distract me, not for a single minute. I knew if I didn't do it right then, I wouldn't ever. I put the reflector box down beside my sewing and said, "Joe." "What?" he asked me. He'd poo-pooed the eclipse before, but now that it had actually started, it seemed like he couldn't take his eyes off it. His head was tipped back, and the eclipse viewer he was looking through cast one of those funny faded shadows on his face. "It's time for the surprise," I said. "What surprise?" he asks. And when he lowered the eclipse viewer, which was just this double layer of special polarized glass in a frame, if I ain't already said so, to look at me, I saw it wasn't fascination with the eclipse after all, or not completely. He was halfway to being shit-faced, and so groggy I got a little scared. If he didn't understand what I was saying, my plan was buggered before it even got started. What was I going to do then? I didn't know. The only thing I did know scared the hell out of me. I wasn't going to turn back. No matter how wrong things went or what happened later, I wasn't going to turn back. Then he reached out a hand, grabbed me by the shoulder, and shook me. "What in God's name you talking about, woman?" he says. "You know the money in the kids' bank accounts?" I asks him. His eyes narrowed a little, and I saw he wasn't anywhere near as drunk as I'd first thought. I understood something else, too. That one kiss didn't change a thing. Anyone can give a kiss, after all. A kiss was how Judas Iscariot showed the Romans which one was Jesus. "What about it?" he says. "You took it. Like hell." "Oh, yes," I says. "After I found out you'd been fooling with Selina, I went to the bank. I meant to withdraw the money, then take the kids and get them away from you." His mouth dropped open, and for a few seconds he just gaped at me. Then he started to laugh. Just leaned back in his rocker and laughed while the day went on getting darker all around him. "Well, you got fooled, didn't you?" he says. Then he helped himself to a little more scotch and looked up at the sky through the eclipse viewer again. This time I couldn't hardly see the shadow on his face. "Half gone, Dolores," he says. "Half gone now, maybe a little more." I looked down into my reflector box and seen he was right. Only half of that 50-cent piece was left, and more was going all the time. "Yeah," I says, "half gone, so it is. As to the money, Joe..." "You just forget that," he told me. "Don't trouble your pointy little head about it. That money's just about fine." "Oh, I'm not worried about it," I says, "not a bit. The way you fooled me, though, that weighs on my mind." He nodded, kind of solemn and thoughtful, as if to show me he understood and even sympathized. But he couldn't hold on to the expression. Pretty soon he busted out laughing again, like a little kid who's getting scolded by a teacher he ain't in the least afraid of. He laughed so hard he sprayed a little silver cloud of spit into the air in front of his mouth. "I'm sorry, Dolores," he says when he was able to talk again. "I don't mean to laugh, but I did steal a march on you, didn't I?" "Oh, yeah," I agreed. It wasn't nothing but the truth, after all. "Fooled you right and proper," he says, laughing and shaking his head the way you do when someone tells a real knee-slapper. "Yeah," I agreed along with him. "But you know what they say." "Nope," he says. He dropped the eclipse viewer into his lap and turned to look at me. He'd laughed so hard there were tears standing in his piggy little bloodshot eyes. "You're the one with a saying for every occasion, Dolores. What do they say about husbands who finally put one over on their meddling busybody wives?" "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me," I says. "You fooled me about Selina, and then you fooled me about the money. But I guess I finally caught up to you." "Well, maybe you did and maybe you didn't," he says. "But if you're worried about it being spent, you can just stop, because..." I broke in there. "I ain't worried," I says. "I told you that already. I ain't a bit worried." He give me a hard look then, Andy, his smile drying up little by little. "You got that smart look on your face again," he says. "The one I don't much care for." "Tough titty," I says. He looked at me for a long time, trying to figure out what was going on inside my head. But I guess it was as much a mystery to him then as ever. He pooched his lip out again and sighed so hard he blew back the lock of hair that had fallen on his forehead. "Most women don't understand the first thing about money, Dolores," he says, "and you're no exception to the rule. I put it all together in one account, that's all. So it'd draw more interest. I didn't tell you because I didn't want to listen to a lot of your ignorant bullshit. Well, I've had to listen to some anyway, like I just about always do, but enough's enough." Then he raised up the eclipse viewer again to show me the subject was closed. "One account in your own name," I says. "So what?" he asked. By then it was like we were sitting in a deep twilight, and the trees had begun fading against the horizon. I could hear a whippoorwill singing from behind the house and a nightjar from somewhere else. It felt like the temperature had begun to drop, too. It all gave me the strangest feeling, like living in a dream that somehow turned real.
"Why shouldn't it be in my name? I'm their father, ain't I?"
"Well, your blood is in 'em. If that makes you a father, I guess you are one." I could see him trying to figure out if that one was worth picking up and yanking on for a while, and deciding it weren't.
"You don't want to talk about this any more, Dolores," he says. "I'm warning you."
"Well, maybe just a little more," I says, back, smiling. "You forgot all about the surprise, you see." He looked at me suspicious again. "What the fuck are you babbling on about, Dolores?" "Well, I went to see the man in charge of the savings department at Coastal Northern in Johnsport," I says. "A nice man named Mr. Pease. I explained what happened, and he was awful upset, especially when I told him the original savings books weren't missing, like you told him they were." That was when Joe lost what little interest in the eclipse he'd had. He just sat there in that shitty old rocker of his, staring at me with his eyes wide open. There was thunder on his brow, and his lips were pressed down into a thin white line like a scar. He dropped the eclipse viewer back into his lap, and his hands were opening and closing real slow. "It turned out you weren't supposed to do that," I told him. "Mr. Pease checked to see if the money was still in the bank. When he found out it was, we both heaved a big sigh of relief. He asked me if I wanted him to call the cops and tell him what happened. I could see from his face he was hoping like hell I'd say no. I asked if he could issue that money over to me. He looked it up in a book and said he could. So I said, 'That's what we'll do then.' And he did it. So that's why I ain't worried about the kid's money anymore, Joe. I've got it now instead of you. Ain't that a corker of a surprise?" "You lie!" Joe shouted at me and stood up so fast his rocker almost fell over. The eclipse viewer fell out of his lap and broke to pieces when it hit the porch floor. I wish I had a picture of the way he looked just then. I'd stuck it to him, all right, and it went in all the way to the hilt. The expression on the dirty son of a whore's face was pretty near worth everything I'd been through since that day on the ferry with Selina. "They can't do that," he yells. "You can't touch a cent of that dough. Can't even look at the fucking passbook." "Oh, no," I says. "Then how come I know you already spent 300 of it? I'm thankful it wasn't more, but it still makes me mad as hell every time I think of it. You're nothing but a thief, Joe St. George. One so low he'd even steal from his own children." His face was as white as a corpse's in the gloom. Only his eyes was alive, and they were burning with hate. His hands was held out in front of him, opening and closing, opening and closing. I glanced down for just a second and saw the sun, less than half by then, just a fat crescent, reflected over and over in the shattered pieces of smoked glass laying around his feet. Then I looked back at him again. It wouldn't do to take my eyes off him for long, not with the mood he was in. "What did you spend that 300 on, Joe? Whores? Poker? Some of both? I know it want another junker, because there ain't any new ones out back." He didn't say nothing, just stood there in front of me with his hands opening and closing, and behind him I could see the first lightning bugs stitching their lights across the dooryard. The boats out on the reach were just ghosts by then, and I thought of Vera. I figured if she wasn't in seventh heaven already, she was probably in the vestibule. Not that I had any business thinking about Vera. It was Joe I had to keep my mind on. I wanted to get him moving, and I judged one more good push would do it. "I guess I don't care what you spent it on anyway," I says. "I got the rest, and that's good enough for me. You can just go fuck yourself. If you can get your old limp noodle to stand up, that is." He stumbled across the porch, crunching the pieces of the eclipse viewer under his shoes, and grabbed me by the arms. I could have gotten away from him, but I didn't want to, not just then. "You want to watch your fresh mouth," he whispered, blowing scotch fumes down into my face. "If you don't, I'm apt to." "Mr. Pease wanted me to put the money back in the bank, but I wouldn't. I figured if you were able to get it out of the kids' accounts, you might find a way to get it out of mine, too. Then he wanted to give me a check, but I was afraid that if you found out what I was up to before I wanted you to find out, you might stop payment on it. So I told Mr. Pease to give it to me in cash. He didn't like it, but in the end he did it. And now I have it, every cent. And I've put it in a place where it's safe." He grabbed me by the throat then. I was pretty sure he would, and I was scared, but I wanted it too. It'd make him believe the last thing I had to say that much more when I finally said it. But even that wasn't the most important thing. Having him grab me by the throat like that made it seem more like self-defense somehow. That was the most important thing. And it was self-defense, no matter what the law might say about it. I know, because I was there, and the law wasn't. In the end, I was defending myself, and I was defending my children. He cut off my wind and throttled me back and forth, yelling. I don't remember all of it. I think he must have knocked my head against one of the porch posts once or twice. I was a goddamn bitch, he said. He'd kill me if I didn't give that money back. That money was his. Foolishness like that. I began to be afraid he really would kill me before I could tell him what he wanted to hear. The dooryard had gotten a lot darker, and it seemed full of those little stitching lights, as if the 100 or 200 fireflies I'd seen before had been joined by 10,000 or so more. And his voice sounded so far away that I thought it had all gone wrong somehow, that I'd fallen down the well instead of him. Finally, he let me go. I tried to stay on my feet, but my legs wouldn't hold me. I tried to fall back into the chair I'd been sitting in, but he'd yanked me too far away from it, and my ass just clipped the edge of the seat on my way down. I landed on the porch floor, next to the litter of broken glass that was all that was left of his eclipse viewer. There was one big piece left, with a crescent of sun shining in it like a jewel. I started to reach for it, then didn't. I wasn't going to cut him, even if he gave me the chance. I couldn't cut him. A cut like that, a glass cut, might not look right later. So you see how I was thinking. Not much doubt any place along the line about whether or not it was first degree, is there, Andy? Instead of the glass, I grabbed hold of my reflector box, which was made of some heavy wood. I could say I was thinking it would do to bash him with if it came to that, but it wouldn't be true. Right then, I really wasn't thinking much at all. I was coughing, though. Coughing so damned hard, it seemed a wonder to me that I wasn't spraying blood as well as spit. My throat felt like it was on fire. He pulled me back onto my feet so hard one of my slip straps broke, then caught the nape of my neck in the crook of his arm and yanked me toward him until we was close enough to kiss. Not that he was in a kissing mood any more. "I told you what had happened if you didn't leave off being so fresh with me," he says. His eyes were all wet and funny, like he'd been crying. But what scared me about him was the way they seemed to be looking right through me, as if I wasn't really there for him any more. "I told you a million times. Do you believe me now, Dolores?" "Yes," I said. He'd hurt my throat so bad I sounded like I was talking through a throat full of mud. "Yes, I do." "Say it again," he says. He still had my neck caught in the crook of his elbow, and now he squeezed so hard it pinched one of the nerves in there. I screamed. I couldn't help it. It hurt dreadful. That made him grin. "Say it like you mean it," he told me. "I do," I screamed. "I do mean it." I'd planned on acting frightened, but Joe saved me the trouble. I didn't have to do no acting that day, after all. "Good," he says. "I'm glad to hear it. Now tell me where the money is, and every red cent better be there." "It's out back of the woodshed," I says. I didn't sound like I was talking through a mouthful of mud any more. By then I sounded like Groucho Marx on You Bet Your Life, which sort of fit the situation, if you see what I mean. Then I told him I put the money in a jar and hid the jar in the blackberry bushes. "Just like a woman," he sneers, and then give me a shove toward the porch steps. "Well, come on, let's go get it." I walked down the porch steps and along the side of the house with Joe right behind me. By then it was almost as dark as it gets at night, and when we reached the shed, I saw something so strange it made me forget everything else for a few seconds. I stopped and pointed up into the sky over the blackberry tangle. "Look, Joe," I says, "stars." And there were. I could see the Big Dipper at 5:15 on that summer's afternoon as clear as I ever saw it on a winter's night. It gave me goosebumps all over my body. But it wasn't nothing to Joe. He gave me a shove so hard I almost fell over. "Stars," he says, "you'll see plenty of 'em if you don't quit stalling, woman. I guarantee you that." I started walking again. Our shadows had completely disappeared, and the big white rock where me and Selina had sat that evening the year before stood out almost as bright as a spotlight, like I've noticed it does when there's a full moon. The light wasn't like moonlight, Andy. I can't describe what it was like, how gloomy and weird it was, but it'll have to do. I know that the distances between things had gotten hard to judge, like they do in moonlight, and that you couldn't pick out any single blackberry bush anymore. They were all just one big smear with those fireflies dancing back and forth in front of them. Vera had told me time and time again that it was dangerous to look straight at the eclipse. She said it could burn your retinas or even blind you. Still, I couldn't no more resist turning my head and taking one quick glance up over my shoulder than Lot's wife could resist taking one last glance back at the city of Sodom. What I saw has stayed in my memory ever since. Weeks, sometimes whole months, go by without me thinking about Joe, but hardly a day goes by when I don't think of what I saw that afternoon when I looked up over my shoulder and into the sky. Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt because she couldn't keep her eyes front and her mind on her business, and I've sometimes thought it's a wonder I didn't have to pay the same price. The eclipse wasn't total yet, but it was close. The sky itself was a deep royal purple, and what I saw hanging in it above the reach looked like a big black pupil with a gauzy veil of fire spread out most of the way around it. On one side there was a thin crescent of sun still left, like beads of molten gold in a blast furnace. I had no business looking at such a sight, and I knew it. But once I had, it seemed like I couldn't look away. It was like, well, you might laugh, but I'm going to say it anyway. It was like that inside eye had gotten free of me somehow, that it had floated up into the sky and was looking down to see how I was going to make out. But it was so much bigger than I'd ever imagined, so much blacker. I probably would have looked at it until I went stone blind, except Joe gave me another shove and bashed me into the shed wall. That kind of woke me up, and I started walking again. There was a great big blue spot, the kind you see after someone takes a flash picture, hanging in front of me, and I thought, if you burned your retinas and have to look at that for the rest of your life, it'll serve you right, Dolores. It wouldn't be no more than the mark Cain had to bear. We walked past the white rock, Joe right behind me and holding on to the neck of my dress. I could feel my slip sliding down one side where the strap had broken. What with the dark and that big blue spot hanging in the middle of things, everything looked off-kilter and out of place. The end of the shed wasn't nothing but a dark shape, like someone had taken a pair of shears and cut a roof-shaped hole in the sky. He pushed me toward the edge of the blackberry patch, and when the first thorn prinked my calf, I remembered that this time I'd forgot to put on my jeans. It made me wonder what else I might have forgot, but of course it was too late to change anything then. I could see that little scrap of cloth fluttering in the last of the light, and had just time to remember how the well cap lay beneath it. Then I tore out of his fist and pelted into the brambles, hell-bent for election. "No, you don't, you bitch!" he bawls at me, and I could hear the bushes breaking as he trampled in after me. I felt his hand grab for the neck of my dress again and almost catch. I jerked loose and kept on going. It was hard to run because my slip was falling down and kept hooking on the brambles. In the end, they unraveled a great long strip of it and took plenty of meat off my legs as well. I was bloody from knees to ankles, but I never noticed till I got back in the house, and that was a long time after. "Come back here," he bellowed, and this time I felt his hand on my arm. I yanked it free, and so he grabbed at my slip, which was floating out behind me like a bridal train by then. If it had held, he might have reeled me in like a big fish. But it was old and tired from being washed 200 or 300 times. I felt the strip he'd got hold of tear away, and heard him curse, kind of high and out of breath. I could hear the sound of the brambles breaking and snapping and whipping in the air, but couldn't see hardly anything. Once we was in the blackberry tangle, it was darker than a woodchuck's asshole. And in the end, that hanky I tied up wasn't any help. I saw the edge of the well cap instead, no more than a glimmer of white in the darkness just ahead of me, and I jumped with all my might. I just cleared it. And because I was facing away from him, I didn't actually see him step onto it. There was a big crack sound. And then he hollered. No, that ain't right. He didn't holler. And I guess you know it as well as I do. He screamed like a rabbit with its foot caught in a slipwire. I turned around and seen a big hole in the middle of the cap. Joe's head was sticking out of it. And he was holding on to one of those smashed boards with all his might. His hands were bleeding, and there was a little thread of blood running down his chin from the corner of his mouth. His eyes were the size of doorknobs.
"Oh, Christ, Dolores," he says. "It's the old well. Help me out quick before I fall all the way in."
I just stood there, and after a few seconds his eyes changed. I seen the understanding of what it had all been about come into him. I was never so scared as I was then, standing there on the far side of the well cap and staring at him with that black sun hanging in the sky to the west of us. I had forgot my jeans, and he hadn't fallen right in like he was supposed to. To me it seemed like everything had started going wrong.
"Oh," he said. "Oh, you bitch."
Then he started to claw and wriggle his way up. I told myself I had to run, but my legs wouldn't move. Where was there to run to, anyway, if he got out? One thing I found out on the day of the eclipse, if you live on an island and you try to kill someone, you better do a good job. If you don't, there's nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. I could hear his fingernails scratching up splinters in that old board as he worked at pulling himself out, hand over hand. That sound is like what I saw when I looked up at the eclipse, something that's always been a lot closer to me than I ever wanted it to be. Sometimes I even hear it in my dreams, only in the dreams he gets out and comes after me again. And that ain't what really happened. What happened was the board he was clawing his way along all of a sudden snapped under his weight, and he dropped. It happened so fast, it was almost like he'd never been there in the first place. All at once, there was nothing there but a saggy gray square of wood with a ragged black hole in the middle of it, and fireflies zipping back and forth over it. He screamed again, going down. It echoed off the sides of the well. That was something else I hadn't figured on, him screaming when he fell. Then there was a thud, and he stopped. Just flat stopped, the way a lamp stops shining if someone yanks the plug out of a wall. I knelt on the ground and hugged my arms across my middle and waited to see if there was going to be any more. Some time went by, I don't know how much or how long, but the last of the light went out of the day. The total eclipse had come, and it was dark as night. There still wasn't any sound coming from the well, but there was a little breeze coming from it toward me. And I realized I could smell it. You know that smell you sometimes get in water that comes from shallow wells? It's a coppery smell. Dank, not very nice. I could smell that, and it made me shiver. I saw my slip was hanging down almost to the top of my left shoe. It was all torn and full of rips. I reached under the neck of my dress on the right side and popped that strap, too. Then I pulled the slip down and off. I was bundling it into a ball beside me and trying to see the best way to skirt around the well cap when all at once I thought of that little girl again, the one I told you about before, and all at once I saw her just as clear as day. She was down on her knees, too, looking under her bed, and I thought, she's so unhappy, and she smells that same smell, the one that's like pennies and oysters. Only it didn't come from the well. It has something to do with her father. And then all at once, it was like she looked around at me, Andy. I think she saw me. And when she did,
I understood why she was so unhappy. Her father had been at her somehow, and she was trying to cover it up. On top of that, she'd all at once realized someone was looking at her. That a woman God knows how many miles away, but still in the path of the eclipse, a woman who just killed her husband, was looking at her. She spoke to me, although I didn't hear her voice with my ears. It came from deep in the middle of my head. "Who are you?" she asked. I don't know if I would have answered her or not, but before I even had a chance to, a long, wavering scream came out of the well.
"Dolores!"
It felt like my blood froze solid inside me, and I know my heart stopped for a second, because when it started again, it had to catch up with three or four beats all crammed together. I'd picked the slip up, but my fingers relaxed when I heard that scream, and it fell out of my hand and caught on one of those blackberry bushes. "It's just your imagination working overtime, Dolores," I told myself. "That little girl looking under the bed for her clothes and Joe screaming like that, you imagined them both. One was a hallucination that somehow come of catching a whiff of stale air from the well, and the other was no more than your own guilty conscience. Joe's laying at the bottom of that well with his head bashed in. He's dead, and he ain't going to bother either you or the kids ever again." I didn't believe it at first, but more time went by and there was no more sound, except for an owl calling somewhere off in a field. I remember thinking it sounded like he was asking how come his shift was getting started so early today. A little breeze ran through the blackberry bushes, making them rattle. I looked up at the stars shining in the daytime sky, then down at the well cap again. It almost seemed to float in the dark, and the hole in the middle he'd fallen through looked like an eye to me. July 20th, 1963 was my day for seeing eyes everywhere. Then his voice come drifting out of the well again.
"Help me, Dolores!"
I groaned and put my hands over my face. It wasn't any good trying to tell myself that was just my imagination, or my guilty conscience, or anything else except what it was, Joe. To me, he sounded like he was crying.
"Help me, please, please,"
he moaned. I stumbled my way around the well cap and went running back along the path we'd beat in the brambles. I wasn't in a panic, not quite, and I'll tell you how I know that. I stopped long enough to pick up the reflector box I'd had in my hand when we started out toward the blackberry patch. I couldn't remember dropping it as I ran, but when I saw it hanging off one of those branches, I grabbed it. Probably a damn good thing, too, considering how things went with that damn Dr. McAuliffe. But that's still a turn or two around the track from where I am now. I did stop to pick it up, that's the point. And to me that says I was still in possession of my wits. I could feel the panic trying to reach underneath them, though, the way a cat'll try to get his paw under the lid of a box if it's hungry and it can smell food inside. I thought about Selena, and that helped keep the panic away. I could imagine her standing on the beach of Lake Winthrop, along with Tanya and 40 or 50 little campers, each camper with his or her own reflector box that they'd made in the handicrafts cabin, and the girl showing them exactly how to see the eclipse in them. It wasn't as clear as the vision I'd had out by the well, the one of the little girl looking under the bed for her shorts and shirt, but it was clear enough for me to hear Selena talking to the little ones in that slow, kind voice of hers, soothing the ones who were afraid. I thought about that, and about how I had to be here for her and her brothers when they got back. Only if I gave in to the panic, I probably wouldn't be. I'd gone too far and done too much, and there wasn't nobody left I could count on except myself. I went into the shed and found Joe's big six-cell flashlight on his work table. I turned it on, but nothing happened. He let the batteries go flat, which was just like him. I keep the bottom drawer of his table stocked with fresh ones, though, because we lose the power so often in the winter. I got half a dozen and tried to fill the flashlight up again. My hands were trembling so bad the first time that I dropped D-cells all over the floor and had to scramble for them. The second time I got them in, but I must have put one or two in bass ackwards in my hurry because the light wouldn't come on.
I thought about just leaving it. The sun'd be coming out again pretty soon, after all. Except it'd be dark at the bottom of the well even after it did come out. And besides, there was a voice in the very back of my mind telling me to keep on fiddling and diddling just as long as I wanted. That maybe if I took long enough, I'd find he'd finally given up the ghost when I did get back out there. At last, I got the flash to work. It made a fine bright light, and before long I found myself wishing it showed less than it did. But at least I was able to find my way back to the well cap without scratching my legs any worse than they already were. I don't have the slightest idea how much time had gone by, but it was still gloomy and there were still stars showing in the sky, so I guess it wasn't yet 6, and the sun still mostly covered.